are coming out of the Emerald Closet. I'm Chris in Portland, and I'm honored to bring you our first female voice in this second episode here. From my half of the interview table, we always have male perspectives covered. So this is the first in what will be many outreach efforts across gender lines to include more voices. Elena brings not only her feminine wisdom, but also her elder wisdom. And by elder, I only mean that she has adult children of her own. However, it's not just her own elder wisdom that she brings, but she also upholds the memories of several other elders whose stories she perpetuates with a few tales of the first above-ground cannabis collectors from the late 90s in California. Elena uses cannabis medicinally. It's the medicine she uses to treat, among other things, her social anxiety. And boy, does it do a good job. Just listen to her open up like a seasoned raconteur who's honed her craft. But don't take my word for it. Let's transport ourselves to a balmy late summer afternoon in August of 2015. Today is September 3rd. It's a Thursday afternoon at 4:28. I'm hanging out with Elena, who will give you a couple words about herself.
Hi, I'm a native Californian transplanted to Portland, and I'm 50. I worked in the medical marijuana in San Francisco before it was legal even for patients, and was a patient and a caregiver, and now I'm in Portland, and I wasn't able to afford to be a patient here, and now it's legal, and I'm trying to find out how it's going here.
Elena was in California and involved in the medical marijuana industry before it was even an industry, before 1998, before the...
1996 in California. 98 in Oregon.
Right. Okay, thanks. So tell me about your personal, any experiences you have around the Cannabis Buyers Club and Dennis Perone. And I'm imagining people were, I mean, even as though it's the Bay Area and cannabis isn't that radical, I'm assuming there had to be some sort of closeting going on around patients. And
it definitely wasn't as open. I was working as a home health aide, CNA, when I first realized that marijuana could be medicinal. A patient taught me that, and he taught me how to bake because he wanted to make some cookies. And basically what I did for Everett was cook for him. And we made flour from the flowers rather than butter, which actually turns out to be a good thing. A lot of people, he had HIV, and a lot of people with HIV and other cancers things have a hard time breaking down fats. And if it's in the butter, you have to break down the fat before your body can access the THC and the other cannabinoids. So I think that's why my cookies were so much stonier than a lot of people's, because I just used the flour. So I learned this from Everett, and when he passed away, not very long after, I went with a friend of mine to be his caregiver at a small shop upstairs above a bar on Church Street at Market, was one of Dennis's cannabis buyer clubs. And it was just the most amazing thing to walk in, and there's this bar, and you can just look at what they have and order things. That was how I started in medical marijuana, was as a caregiver. And I wound up being a patient. It really makes a lot of difference for a lot of different illnesses. And a lot of people have been able to give up a lot of different pills that the doctors put them on. I'm sure that you've heard that story. Lots of time, that's a pretty common story. And it's not something I think that people who aren't familiar with marijuana really realize how many different medicines can be replaced by marijuana if you're one of the people that it's a good medicine for. And it has a lot less side effects than some of the prescriptions I was prescribed for post-traumatic stress disorder.
Okay, so your use as a patient was rooted in PTSD.
Yes.
Were you a recreational or spiritual user before then?
I had been a recreational user, and the first time I used it, you're a kid. It wasn't really very interesting to me. I didn't really like it. When I was first suffering with what was post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms. I smoked it a lot, and then I stopped for a while. And then when I was going into human caregiving, I sort of sprung off from my patient Everett, who it helped him eat and it helped him not be in pain. And I don't know, he was just a really great guy. I really liked him, and I was really sad that he wanted to leave this world. But, you know, when you're in a certain amount of pain, you want to go. But I still think of him all the time because he's the one that taught me to bake with pot. And then my dad and I would bake for clubs. He was very open about pot. He didn't have an issue with it. I never had to come out to him. He had been an old hippie, and he had smoked a little bit as a youth, but it wasn't really his thing. Although when we baked, he swore he got stoned. Knowing about vaporizers, that's actually a possibility. He was a lightweight. I used to laugh at him.
So baking in your oven could vaporize some of it?
I think so, because I used to laugh. I used to think he was imagining it. But now thinking about vaporizers, I thought, you know, maybe he was getting a little bit of a contact high. And who am I to judge? Because whenever a cookie broke, I was always ready to eat some. And eating it is very different and very much stronger than smoking. Or, you know, vaporizing is actually a little bit stronger than smoking as well. But eating is really much stronger.
Yeah, I've had my experiences with vaping have been mainly through pens. And I'm just really, I haven't quite learned exactly how to use them yet. I mean, I understand the basics, but I haven't gotten high off of just a pen. I generally had it and then kind of said, like, that's all fine and wonderful. I'm going to roll a joint now. This has whet my appetite. It's a wonderful appetizer, but now I'm going to, you know, do the deal.
One of my buddies in San Francisco, he really prefers his pipe. He doesn't necessarily turn down the vaporizer, but he prefers the pipe. I actually think that the vaporizer is a little stronger because the first time I used a vaporizer, it was sort of a homemade version. It was Dr. John, who had been a good friend and a grower for Dennis Perone at the Cannabis Buyers Club, and he had a club called Flower Therapy, which opened up not too long after the CBC was closed by the DEA in 96, right around the time that legalization happened. And Dr. John had one of those torch things that you use for metalwork or whatever, and we kind of used this fake vaporizer that he did, which was kind of scary because, you know, you got that big blowtorch. And I don't remember how that affected me. But the first time I sat down at a volcano was at the Vapor Room in San Francisco, California. And, wow, I had that same kind of feeling that the first time when you smoke pot and your head is really rushed. But after a long time, it's just, you sort of have a more of a tolerance. So you don't necessarily feel a high, but you still get the medical effects. You're not, whatever your problem is, maybe. With me, I wouldn't be as angsty. But this was different. It was like pot was new again. And it was kind of interesting. I like it, and I think it's a really good way to use it, especially if you have any respiratory issues.
Mm-hmm.
Although eating it is what some people prefer because they really have bad respiratory issues where even vaporizing is beyond their lung capacity.
Mm-hmm.
But again, that's a totally different high, and it's harder to modulate.
Yeah, I'm interested in exploring the different highs. I've been smoking and using combustion from ever since. Like, that's pretty much all I've done. Right now, I'm smoking before I go to the gym, before I lift weights and do cardio and stuff. And I have a feeling that edibles would be even better for that. I mean, besides the irritation to my throat and lungs, I just have this feeling that the high will be more of what I'm interested in, more, which is sensitizing my muscle groups so that I can isolate them better, you know, from one machine to the next.
You are not the first person I've heard talk about liking to get stoned before they go to the gym. I had a friend in California who, that was his, I mean, he got stoned other times as well, but it was definitely important to do before the gym because then he enjoyed his workout. He would just keep doing it and, you know, kind of space off or whatever. He enjoyed it, though, more. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and also turning 40, I made a big break from what I would call raising plates, which is just, this is the amount of weight I lift. I lift it 8 times, you know, 3 sets, 60 seconds apart.
And I'd do whatever it would take to lift it that many times. But now I'm less interested with those numbers and more interested in purely isolating my muscle groups and my curls. If I had to use maybe some shoulder or some neck leverage to lift it, those number 7 and number 8 reps, then now I don't mind leaving those out, and I really just want to get my biceps as completely isolated as possible. And I feel I get a much deeper workout. As for my physique, I don't really know if there's been a whole lot of difference, but I feel a lot better, and I've always taken to weightlifting as a... I just enjoy using the different parts of my body. You know, modern life has us sitting on our asses for a long time, and it's easy to not, you know, to let a lot of our... So I like the idea of, like, bodily involvement and exertion, and I have a feeling that edibles, switching to edibles, will even more deeply penetrate that.
It is. I think you might very well be right. And as far as you feeling better, and you don't know if you look different, unless you're going for bodybuilding contests, the thing is really that you're supposed to feel better. And
yeah,
the whole thing about marijuana is that you're just supposed to feel better, whether you're a recreational user and you just need a little lift or something to be funny, or you're a medical patient, it's about feeling better.
Sure. So you had mentioned that you were working, while you were doing some caregiving work in the medical marijuana field, that you were also federally employed, even though it was, you were saying, just as a census, in the census department. So no, I don't imagine anyone was really on top of you.
No. I imagine that my direct supervisor, she was an older hippie, nice lady. She probably had a clue, but we didn't talk about it because when I had been a caregiver and a patient and was using marijuana, so I'm not obvious. Mm-hmm. Even a good friend of mine that I would hang out at the vapor room, we were at the vapor room before we went to a party at Dennis's house, and we were pretty toasted then, had baked goods, smoked, vaporized, etc. Then we went to Dennis's house, and there was this party for the Americans for Safe Access. Dennis was out of town, but there were baked goods and smoking. And when we left, my friend looked at me, and he knew me pretty well, and he said, "You know, I've seen you consume a lot of pot today, and you don't seem any different." I said, "Well, I feel different." So it really depends. I mean, some people, yeah, especially when you're new to it, you can seem very different and goofy.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other people that function, and you would never even guess unless they told you that they were... I mean, you become desensitized to any sort of medicine. Like, anytime you start a medicine, a pill that a doctor prescribes you, you might seem off and a little bit different, but after you've taken it for a while, if it's not an allergy, you become used to it, and you function at a level that's normal.
Mm-hmm.
Marijuana is the same way.
Yeah, like, those steps are very familiar to me. I feel like I've kind of taken another step, or a step backwards, in that now I want to be, when I'm high, I don't want to put any energy into not appearing high. That feels totally counterproductive to me. During my 20s, I was very into, hey, I can ride my bike from City Hall to pay my gas bill over to this place to pay my electric bill. And because I've been taught sort of a motivational syndrome and, you know, general apathy, to me, I felt like it was very liberating to, you know, to be very active, to run all these different errands, very responsible ones. And I was noticing that I was really, there was a lot of gusto towards, I'm not lazy, I'm not irresponsible, I'm quick-witted. But then, sometime in my 30s, I began realizing, why am I getting high and then putting energy on top of that to make sure I'm as unhigh appearing as normal? And so then it became this challenge of just like, you know what, I'm going to be at my house where I don't have those sorts of obligations, or I don't have those feelings of needing to prove something to anyone. And yet, have I forgotten what it is to just be unobstructed stone? And so that's kind of what I've been working on since then, is be stoned when you're stoned. That's ridiculous to go do, you know, take bong hits and get high, and then exert all this energy to make sure that you're acting as quote-unquote normal as possible.
I never really cared, but I've always been that kind of person that I'm open, and what I say, I may say things people don't like, but it's because I would prefer to tell the truth, and I don't like having to hide things. It's just too difficult. It's just more work, and not to go with the apathy thing. It's just, that's my way. And if I seem high, then oh well. But usually I don't. But it's not because I'm trying to hide. Although I do remember that, yes, as a kid, that hiding that you're high from your family.
Yeah, like, just as an adult, there was just no reason. It was just silly. It was like revving your engine. It's like pressing the gas and the brake at the same time. Why am I getting high just to pretend that I'm not high? Like, that's kind of silly. And, you know, some of that had to do with going to work. I'm a morning person, and so, you know, once I got comfortable at my job, I might smoke pot, not right before I go, but I might smoke pot maybe a few hours before my work shift begins. So I might still be a little bit high, and of course I wouldn't want anyone to know, not my coworkers, not my boss. And then I think it was actually during work, I was really patting myself on the back for handling a situation that came up really well, and people commending me on it, and I was like, wow, and I'm stoned? Nuts! And I was really self-congratulatory about it in my mind. It was something about that, and I was just like, wait a second, what kind of a victory is that? I can get stoned and then make myself, and then act as unstoned as possible. And I'd also recently just heard this chant that had to do with, it was sung by, I think Allen Ginsberg recorded it on the Rolling Thunder tour in 1976 with Bob Dylan. A lot of it is, it's like, walk when you walk, breathe when you breathe.
It's like a meditation.
Die when you die. I think die when you die was like the big clincher, but it was basically, yeah, the same, the first and last word of each sentence would be the same. Be like, eat when you eat. You know, kind of like, don't read the paper. Don't be checking up on things. Chew your food, taste it, swallow it, determine how hungry you need to be and all that. Eat when you eat. And so I kind of had this equivalent of, be stoned when you're stoned. Don't put your energy towards not being, looking high. No, be just high when you're high. Don't try to act not high. Here you go.
Thank you.
All right.
That makes sense. I've always kind of been a different person. I grew up in a small town, and I wasn't your normal person, and I was a punk, too. I had a mohawk, and even the boys in the town wouldn't do that. So I've always kind of just been, you know, whatever, you don't like it, too bad. Mm-hmm. This is me, I'm not hurting you. It's usually a big F off. You know, a sassy punk. But I still hold that way pretty much with everything. Like I said, it's just easier in my life to be that way.
Yeah, that honesty, I think, is really at the core of coming out. I think that there's living in that honesty. There's a freedom that I feel is not even previously even known until you can live like that. I guess trying to think of other situations in which come out to people and it's been, and how different it's been since then. And what has been different?
Yeah, where I first was before I moved to San Francisco, Sacramento was the big city to go to. Because you could get there in 45 minutes, whereas it was about 2 hours to San Francisco.
Right.
So we could go dancing in Sacramento.
Proximity, man. It's important.
Yeah. But going all the way to San Francisco for dancing was not really feasible if you're done at 2 in the morning and you still have 2.5 hours to drive. Yeah. 45 minutes was a much easier drive, so that's okay. Where I spent some of my youth.
So you're a Sacramento punk, like, around what years now?
Let's see. Mid-70s.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I always wanted to live in San Francisco because, of course, that's where a lot of the punk bands were from.
Sure.
Although, farther north, there were bands, too. I was in a band, Vocal Chaos, and we got to play warm-up for Rebel Truth and the Circle Jerks, sorry, because someone didn't show
Holy
up.
Holy shit, dude.
So we didn't even have to be the first band on. I was really thrilled.
The Circle Jerks came on after you?
Yep.
what?
But we're a warm-up band. You know, if they come on before you, then it's like, what?
Yeah. But still, though, man, that's, I mean, it's sharing a stage. That's different than seeing them, you know?
Yeah, oh, yeah. That like, was pretty like awesome, as a, yeah. Rebel Truth is a really good band. You can still find some of their stuff around. They actually were one of the most productive Sacramento Valley bands. Other than Tales of Terror, which Rat's Ass and I kind of always hated him, the little bastard. You can see I was always sort of a hard-headed, I have my own ideas, and I'm going to say what I think, and don't ask me what I think if you don't want to know. But yeah, and then when I moved to San Francisco, obviously I felt like it was a much easier place to be, much more accepting.
What year was that?
Let's see, I was 18. 82, 83.
Okay.
And then I lived there until a couple of years ago. I went and lived a year in Russia, which I did without marijuana then. Although there is cannabis there, it grows wild. It's ruderalis as opposed to indica or sativa, and I have to try that. And then I moved back to California, and the housing was just crazy there. So I wound up here in Portland.
Okay.
And, I knew that they had medical marijuana. I didn't realize that it was a lot more expensive and rope jumping to get in on the medical marijuana here.
I guess an investment to begin. That's like several hundreds of dollars.
Yeah. San Francisco and even LA, you could find a doctor for $40 to $80 if your own regular physician wasn't comfortable writing for it. I had a regular physician that was comfortable. Well, I believe it was my very first note. It was actually from Dr. Todd Nicaria, who'd been the Fed's marijuana doctor until his results were not what the federal government wanted to know, because he found that marijuana was very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to meet that luminary as well. And wow. He was my first prescription. And I had two doctors after that who were just my regular doctors. And then I would go to just one of the places where you just pay a doctor, basically. They check you out, your meds, what your diagnosis is. Yeah, marijuana works for that. Then they write you a prescription. And then to come here and find out that most of your doctors are afraid to do it, or the hospital that they work for, it's just prohibited for them to do it, and that you have to pay the same kind of, and I hate to call it this because they're not all just mills, but some of them are just mills, the doctors.
Oh, okay.
Prescription mills. Rather than paying 40, maybe 80, it was at least 200. And then you had to register with the state here. It's compulsory. It's not an option. In California, you could or you couldn't register with the state. It doesn't matter. And the city hospital general, San Francisco General, their doctors were fine with writing prescriptions for it. But here, I'm a Providence patient, and that's a big no-no.
Providence won't...
No.
Interesting.
Although the lady at the vaporizer shop where I got my new kit for my Volcano when I needed them, I believe she said she went to Providence. Her diagnosis is cancer, though. And I think you'd have to be pretty much of a jerk to deny a cancer patient. Although there are people that would.
I've seen some footage.
But I loved it. Oh, God, I miss San Francisco so much sometimes. You could, after it became legal for patients, you could, well, cops already were not. They were just basically maybe dump it on the ground and step on it. And maybe at the most you'd get a citation. After 96, and especially in the last several years, you'd be walking down the street and you smell it and you know someone's smoking. And then you walk a couple more feet while you don't smell it, and then you smell it again. You could smoke while you're waiting for the bus. I mean, you don't want to be obvious, but you also don't have to hide. Just act like it's normal.
Yeah.
And it's perfectly acceptable. Mm-hmm. I mean, people, be as considerate at least as cigarette smokers, although some of them aren't. You know, if you're in a bus stop and it's kind of enclosed, go outside. I certainly hope cigarette smokers do that, because I do have respiratory issues and try to vaporize or do edibles. But I would smoke out on the street. There was a time at first when I was a little more circumspect, but I just became really open about it. And then I moved here, and I realized that even the people that are open about it here aren't really San Francisco open about it.
Do you feel it's done more clumsily? Do you feel that it's more either Austin?
I don't know. I just think it's different.
Like, standoffishly? I don't know. Sometimes I get the feeling that there's less discreet smoking and more obnoxious smoking. Or just inconsiderate, I should say.
That could be. I haven't
granted, really... I'm from the East Coast. I'm very into hiding it and the whole, like, act like nothing's different. That's kind of how you had to do it. It had to be your MO.
East Coast, so you must love the bud here then, because it's a huge difference. East Coast, everything I ever had from the East Coast was swag. Although a couple of the best growers I knew back in California had come from the East Coast. So it's not that you don't know how to grow it back there. It's just for some reason the stuff on the coast out here seems to be better. At least talking 10, 20 years ago, I haven't been to the East and I don't know what's going on there now.
Well, I can tell you from having been smoking in the East since October 89 up until I moved. Most of the pot I smoked when I first started, sometimes it would be called red hair. Most of the time we just called it pot. We really didn't notice much of a variety in it. And it was really good. I was really satisfied. I got really high when I smoked it. I remember that indoor revolution when there was some hydroponic you could get for a while, which was double pricey and allegedly that much stronger. And then I think I got kind of stubborn. And I was like, you know what, man? I like a lot of people making a big cloud in a room. I don't want to just have one hit. I like a smoking ritual. And so I really kind of stuck to my guns.
You would have loved the clubs then.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I don't know about here because I haven't gone to get my papers here other than the one pre-legalization visit to a club in Portland. I don't know what they're like, but in San Francisco, the majority of them that I spent time in, there were smoking facilities and or vaporizing facilities. Okay. As a matter of fact, I helped with Dr. Harvey Feldman, did a study in somewhere between 96 and 98. If you Google it, it's online. It's about the socialization aspect of the medical marijuana clubs and that it's beneficial. I actually think that's true because a lot of the people, that was the main part of their socialization, was the time that they would spend at the clubs. And when Dennis's club was first shut down, for a while, other than flower therapy, some of the other clubs weren't having smoking facilities because now it was legal and the city is kind of telling you what you can do and what you can't do. And I don't know, I do miss the camaraderie of those kind of clubs where you smoke and you hang out with people. And, you know, it's all kinds of people. We had a former district attorney who they referred to as the cannabis DA, Keith, and he would come in there. He wrote some hate crime legislation, too. He's, you know, a really big wig kind of guy. He got...
That's cool.
Yeah, he had AIDS, was his diagnosis. Mm-hmm. He had some liver issues with toxicity and ammonia, and it affected his thinking a little bit, and so he retired from the DA's office. But he would come, he'd hang out at the vapor room. Really nice man. It was just, you meet all kinds of people. You meet from the street people and the hippies to the business person that stops during their lunch break to take their medicine and purchase something for later, spend a little bit of time talking to people, and then go back to work. You get a broad spectrum, and people that you might not have any social discourse with any other place other than you already know them from the club, so you would.
Mm-hmm.
But if without the clubs, there's a lot of those people I would never meet, and I think fondly of almost every one of them.
In Virginia, even, we talk a lot about smoking pot as a way of, not as a way, but finding yourself with people that you wouldn't otherwise be hanging out with. And that being in a positive way. I mean, now that the words come out of my mouth, it sounds like a kind of a dare campaign. But no, but I did find myself meeting people that I otherwise would have either assumed we wouldn't have gotten along or would have just passed by or whatever.
Yeah, and I cannot remember the exact conclusion of the study, though I said it is, again, it's online. Besides it being beneficial, there were a lot of patients, some due to severe illness of just physical, others because, like, with me with PTSD, I have social issues, anxiety issues, but even it would encourage people to go out, and it was beneficial, and I don't know if Oregon is like that, because I haven't participated in medical marijuana clubs here since it became legal, only pre-legalization. And I'm kind of hoping that when it becomes legal to actually purchase it, since you can smoke it, grow it, have it, but not buy it here until October, I wonder if there's going to be anybody that makes that kind of a situation where there's a room where you can purchase your medicine and they have a couple bongs, you can bring your pipe, maybe vaporizers and that people sit around and socialize. That would be really interesting to see. I think that if anybody bothers to do studies, that socialization for people is really very beneficial.
I'm actually, this Sunday, I've made a date with a friend to go to the other spot. There's that. Have you heard of that or the world? There's the other spot and the world famous cannabis cafe, which are public consumption sites, the newscaster in me would call it. And yeah, they're sort of like the edge of the radical social experiment, but just public where people can consume together in a place.
You already know way more about it than me. I'm so social phobic. I haven't gone out to any place here and just started smoking.
Well, I know that the Madeline, the woman who started World Famous, she started in the medical scene, and that was her thing, was a really big piece of healing is camaraderie and community and
definitely
the sort of outward relationships, getting beyond the self relationship. That was like a big chunk of the healing process. So her previous spots had been consumption. This is kind of an example of private consumption.
Yeah.
But I'm also, I'm very interested in what people would like public consumption to be. We all kind of have this what I don't want mentality. I think the conversation, I'd like to hear it more towards what do we want it to look like. I know you don't like any of it anywhere. That's a given. Now that it's happening, which is the reality, what would you like it to look like? I understand that you hate it and you're totally against it. Point taken, duly noted. I get it. That was what I was going to ask you, was about what your experiences with public ingestion spots in Portland, and if none in Portland, then in California. Like, what do you think would be like an evolutionary step, learning from California's public consumption, their stage? Where should we take it next to learn from that? What would you like to see?
I'm going to tell you a little bit about Dennis's second big club. Now, he had the little one that above the bar at church near Market. After that, he got a 5-story with a basement building at the corner of Venice and Market. Very big intersection. Very big building. Now, the basement was pretty much off limits except to staff. And the ground floor was your entrance. The second floor was office and a couple living spaces. The third floor was smoking area and Mexican bud. The fourth floor was your high-grade bud and baked goods, etc. I think maybe the baked goods are on the third, too. Anyway, also smoking area, high-grade California bud. And the fifth floor was another employees-only where trimming and things went on and packaging. That was one of a lifetime sort of ways for it to be. Dennis and other people put oranges for people, and once a week we would make food because we had a lot of poor people. A lot of medical marijuana patients are not very healthy and on a lower socioeconomic spectrum, which is why the prices here in Oregon have been so disappointing.
In dispensaries or street prices?
As far as actually getting your papers.
Oh, okay.
Not the actual prices.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, the prices of being a patient.
Okay.
And Dennis had compassion, which was, some bags, 8s of Mexican for people that had no money. And frequently he'd give, people would hit him up for money. And he was always helping people. And he wanted the price to drop. And he wanted it to be kind of a hippie thing, but it actually in a good way. Usually I kind of have this thing about when I say hippie, I'm thinking bad. But, that's not necessarily so. And it was more like it was a spiritual thing. Not that everybody there was spiritual, but it was just, it was just kind of amazing. So there was that huge place, and then it got closed completely in 1996 by the DEA. Mm. Some of the smaller clubs had sitting rooms and smoking spaces. I think that's probably the optimum. I don't think that we could ever have a giant 5-story place like that again. And it may have been too much, but the DA came in. George Zimmerman, not the child killer, but the Men's Warehouse, he was a supporter. We had reporters that would come in. I mean, lots of San Francisco luminaries came in there.
Yes, the vanguard of evolved social practices.
Yeah. Now, the last club I worked at was a smaller place. We didn't have a smoking area. Not that we wouldn't have allowed it, it's just we were too small. And it was in a rough neighborhood, and they'd actually been robbed at shotgun. The only club I ever worked at that actually had an armed guard But I must say I liked it. I don't know how much I should say of this, but part of what I really like about the medical marijuana is a little bit of an outlaw. We know it's right. We know that everybody should have access to it, except for maybe children. And, you know, it's not for everybody. So if you don't want it and if you don't have a good experience with it, then it's not for you. But we had this policy that if you were 50, you were old enough to know that you wanted pot. So you show us your ID, we let you in. A little bit outlaw, a little stretching along.
But that's, that's what it needs.
But I think that's perfectly appropriate. And I really love and admire Mr. Prune for that and the way that he was so generous with everyone.
Yeah.
And a cafe-sized place where you can purchase your baked goods and smokables and concentrates, and then an area where you can take a little medicine and spend a little time with people is probably the ultimate way to do it if you have the space. And depending on what the laws say, a lot of those places were forced to move or close because of proximity to schools. Like a school kid can't find even worse than marijuana on the street if they're looking to buy something like that.
I mean, they can find Adderall and refined sugars and processed carbohydrates in the schools and cleaning agents, things, toxic things.
Yeah,
toxic.
one of the people in
not non-toxic things.
One of the people in my band, he used to like to huff off his sock. Talk about killing brain cells. I don't even know.
Huff off his own...
He would just spray aerosol stuff.
Oh, okay.
And then put this... And he would be so stupid for like a couple minutes and fall off his chair. He thought he was having fun. And while he was laughing at him was fun laughing. But, yeah, kids can find things that are far more damaging than a plant, especially if it's not adulterated with something else. If it's just cannabis.
And even in respect to children, a lot of talk about children's safety gets equated with separating them from cannabis or marijuana. In my opinion, if a child is ready to begin experiment with getting high or wants to, whatever the reason there is that they have to want to get high, I'd much rather they do that with cannabis than with aerosol or with alcohol or with any of the other sort of agents and chemicals that you can find in scramble, especially when you are young and you don't have that sense of risk aversion. Those parts of your brains aren't developed. That's why I rode without a seatbelt, staring at myself in a car going like, this makes no sense. This is the dumbest thing I've ever heard of, but I wouldn't buckle it for whatever reason because, you know, I was like, I knew it could kill me.
Most kids are risk takers.
Yeah. So I would much rather they do that with cannabis than with whatever else they will get their hands on if they don't have access to something. But the safest way of doing that, if you really, you want to get high, you want to shift in consciousness, that's a human appetite, had it ever since.
Kids are prone to illnesses too.
Yeah, yeah.
Like I know that they're still developing, so it's different than when you're an adult. But, you know, if you're going to do it, you're going to do it. My patient that taught me how to bake with pot was a father of two teens, and when they came to visit him, he preferred to have them smoke the pot at his place. So he knew what they had and that they were okay and safe and they were in a safe environment, rather than go out and go with their friends and get drunk and take whatever kind of drugs. Because a lot more than just inhaler stuff. I mean, there's a lot more that's available. I don't even know all the stuff that's available, but they've talked about, there was something I saw in some show called ICE, which is part of bonding fluid, and then everybody's read about the bath salts, which I can't even understand why anybody would want to do that. You know, crack is a huge epidemic. If you're worried about your kid having a plant, there's a lot more to worry about, and if you make something so forbidden, there are those children and adults that once something is forbidden, it becomes very much more wanted, desirable. So, I mean, I understand if people don't like it. That's not me. But just know that if you tell your children that something is really forbidden, you might actually be tempting them to try something they didn't care about at all. So just acting like it's a regular thing is probably the best. And if you have underage children, which I don't, and I don't provide to any children,
Mm-hmm.
Then it's probably better that you're open about it. And like my friend, patient, who had his sons do it at home so that he knew that they were okay.
I understand it's a really difficult topic to broach, but I do think that a parent can have a very productive role overseeing their children getting high. And our children, of course, I don't want to put a number on it, but overseeing them and just all the things that we think are common sense often don't always happen. Things about, even something as like leaving a bottle on the floor. You know what? Someone's going to kick it. It's going to get kicked. Just don't do it. You can avoid this if you want and watch it happen. Now, I think that parents do have a role. You can have a role. When I say oversee, I mean not, if you don't want to tell them what to do, that's fine. But just keeping an eye on unsafe practices, on effective practices. And that's my only fear, like with my own son seeing it, as you mentioned, like it's a regular thing. I'm just like, oh man, I hope he doesn't decide very well thought and planned out. Well, Dad, you know, sometimes gets high and then rides his bike, over to run errands. I have a bunch of errands to run today, so I think it would be a perfect I wouldn't want him to get the idea, like, it, you know, when you say, like, it's a regular thing, I also want him to know that when you do start, it's going to be really different, and it's going to be psychedelic experience. So, have close friends with you, people with your best interests in mind. I have, like, you know, my two best friends. We all were there for each other in that respect. There was no, like, oh, he's not breathing, is it a big laugh or something like that? It was just like, you know what, man? You're too upset right now to even take bong hit one, so let's just talk and hash things out, and then we'll get cool, and then we'll get high.
Our society looks at drinking as regular. That used to annoy my father when I said it. Drinking is considered normal.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I meant as... Even cigarette smoking, although there are people that demonize it, and I can understand, while I don't believe in prohibition, I also don't like cigarette smoke in my lungs.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is, even though I'm coughing a little bit from my medicine, which I have a good response in other aspects other than the coughing, I don't want to cough from cigarettes, which don't do anything good for me and aren't for me anyway. But I mean, just treat it regularly. Like, those things are treated regularly, not some taboo, you can't do it, because then you're going to tempt kids that might not have cared about it. And as a matter of fact, I started college at 15. I got out of high school and started college. And at the junior college, because my grandparents were afraid to have me go away to school at such a young, which I can understand because I was a risk taker.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I was going to junior college, and I met the graphic artist at Yuba College, and she was my best friend, but I was, you know, 15, 16, and she was 32. We reconnected through Facebook recently, and that's always great because I haven't seen her in years. God, where was I going? Oh, her children. She and her husband were both probably actually medical users. They both have Asperger's, which can also be very good for Asperger's because there's a lot of tension and... People don't understand you, and there's social phobias because you don't necessarily have the same reactions that other people have because you don't think quite the same. I think mm-hmm. We're just wired differently when we think like that. But both of their children, well, I can't swear to the other one. They're like close to 40 now. Children is relative. I know at least the younger of the two boys has no desire to have anything to do with pot ever. Though, sadly, he has a bit of an issue with another substance that's very illegal, too.
Sure.
So, yeah, I don't mean to make it... When they made it normal, their kid just kind of rebelled and didn't want to do that because that was what mom and dad did. So acting that it's normal doesn't mean that it's going to encourage people to do that because you never know. There's a lot of variability in humans.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in kids.
And one thing I'm glad my son sees is varieties of cannabis users. He sees me being very kind of domestically responsible. There is some kind of formality sometimes to how I use it. And he's walked with me through the park and seen the wino-ish types who are also smoking pot.
That's a wide spectrum of people, really.
And we
had several seniors that just looked like really straight. And I don't mean Brownie Mary.
And he sees people in between, there. Too, you know. So it's like, I'm glad that he does have that kind of well-rounded, you can do that with it, or you can do this. I'm sorry.
That's okay. It just made me think of a story about one of our seniors that was often on TV. Now, Mary was kind of a different thinker, too. One of those, she could cuss like a trucker. A sailor and a trucker. But there was another lady, Hazel Rogers. She's since passed, and she was really nice. And she was also one of our seniors, and beautiful white hair, and the news when they weren't concentrating on showing the marginal part of our population, would also talk to Hazel. And one time I had made some baked goods. I used to get like a pound of Mexican butt. Really, I would just give this to me, and I would take it home, and I would make it into flour and bake with it. And she ate one of my baked goods, and in the lobby, or was it, I can't remember if it was the lobby or the second floor, but there were a lot of people around. Hazel comes up to me, and she asks me quite seriously, "Did you put something besides marijuana in those baked goods?" Because I was so, and I'm like, you know, of course I'm like, my heart's fluttering and I'm panicking because all these people are looking at me, no, I swear, because it was just, you know, baking product and this ground up made into flour bud.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the big difference that eating can make, which I think is something that as it becomes more normalized in our society, when people first try eating it, you really need to gauge yourself and go slow. I would warn people all the time. Now, the butter ones don't seem to be as strong, although there are plenty of people that would get high on them. But I was making the flour, and a lot of people now use kief or hash, which is also pretty darn potent if you put enough in. But you need to be careful. I would warn people, eat a third to a half of this. And when they didn't listen to me, they would have the sort of experience like Hazel Rogers had. And other people who have gone to the emergency room because they ate a baked good and then thought they were dying.
Sure, yeah, because it's different. You're like, wait a second, this isn't pot, because you're thinking this isn't smoked pot.
Right, which made me feel really, when this nice senior lady is saying this to me, I felt kind of concerned, but I knew that I hadn't put anything else in it. And then finding out over the years later that that's actually kind of a common reaction for some people. So being careful when you're eating baked goods is very important, especially because the ones I had, even though they were very green, I heard from most people that they tasted really good.
Mm.
And so they would keep eating. One of my neighbors was 70-something, and she called up my friend Pearl at the hair shop, another friend of mine in my old hood. And she, I don't remember what Pat's talking, Pat talked crazy anyway. So she's talking crazy, off the hook to Pearl. And then the next day she called Pearl, and she hadn't remembered calling her at all. She goes, she was right. I shouldn't have eaten all that baked good. So now I also say, eat a third to a half. And also have some other baked goods around or something to snack on so that you're not tempted to just go ahead and eat that cookie. Because Pearl once did the same thing, even though she knew better because Pat had called her. She was in the car. And it was hot. She was with Brandy. And Brandy was going in the shop. Pearl all of a sudden felt very uncomfortable in the car. She rolled up the window on a hot day and just sat there waiting and said, "I'm never going to eat baked goods again." And then she gave one to her granddaughter, also an adult, because Pearl is older than me. She has great-grandchildren. She's in her 70s. She gave one to a grandchild or a niece, someone of age, who started nibbling on the cookie and knew about the half to a third and couldn't resist because she liked the taste. Someone I've never even met had no reason to say that to me. And she ate the whole cookie and she got to work and she couldn't even remember how to get her bra on. It took her 30 minutes trying to figure it out. And then she laughed and knew that she was high and that maybe she ate too much of the cookie. So anybody that's listening to this and learning about it and hasn't tried baked goods, please be careful. And especially if it's a baked good that actually has flour and looks green, or if it's made with kief or hash, because it can be strong. If it's made with butter, you probably don't have to be careful. At least I never had to.
Start low, go slow, I think is the slogan that they're running with, either in Colorado, maybe even in Oregon. That's kind of the public campaign, is start low, go slow.
Yeah, there have been stories about college kids and cops and other people eating these baked goods and getting all panicked and thinking they were dying and going to the emergency room. So definitely, pot is not going to kill you.
My experience with baked goods has either been nothing happened or overdoing it because I was like, well, nothing did it. And then getting real paranoid. I think I was holed up in my room with my notebook, writing lyrics to song melodies. And then someone was coming over to pick up. I had some extra plants. I was growing indoors, and I had more females. Didn't have enough space. So this guy said, "Oh, I'll put him in my backyard."
That's always an awesome situation.
So he's coming over.
I'll take your extra females.
Yeah, but like since he was like my wife's coworker, and I had hung out with him once or twice. He's totally cool guy. But I'm totally paranoid. And so he comes over to pick him up, and I'm just like calling her at work, like, "What do you know about this guy?" And like I totally overdid it.
Yeah, baked goods. Sadly, that's the way I found that a lot of the butter made ones, it's just like a regular baked good to me. So why bother? Because I don't need the sugar, and I'd rather have a baked good that I know is going to work.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like if you're going to consume cannabis, you might as well do whole plant nutrition and get that whole entourage effect of, you know, a little bit of leaf material, a little bit of the rest of the... It's not just the trichomes that are therapeutic. There's a lot of interactions going on.
If you... My recommendation for anybody that wants to try cooking with it is obviously take the whole bud. You can even use leaf or trim, whatever you have access to. Obviously, bud is... If you can, that's the best. I would grind it and grind it and grind it until it was very fine. And then sift it with a flour sifter. And then just use it as a replacement for the flour. Maybe half of the amount of flour, although I've done the full amount of flour switch before. That's definitely a batch that is for only experienced users.
Right, so. Yeah, the upper echelons.
Yeah. Or, you know, kief or hash is also be more careful with because concentrates are a little bit more intense as well. But the butter... I've never really been very high or felt much of any effect on the butter, so. And I always think, like Dennis raised me to think that it's something you share. So when I knew people in San Francisco that were very proprietary about their recipes, which I thought was kind of antithetical to the whole environment and movement.
Mm-hmm.
I always told people, because most, you know what? People are still going to want your baked goods, even if you tell them how to do it, because it's just easier. And you're making a whole batch because it's not just for you, or maybe it is, but you have it in your freezer for a long time. But most people just want a couple. And I think that's why some people were proprietary, as they were thinking, well, there goes my income source. But I don't know, I think people should be able to know how to bake with it most effectively. I mean, that's, why should that be my secret? Why should I not pass it on? I think I want to pass it on. And I have passed it on to other people, and I continue to pass it on to other people. One of my favorite recipes, and it was the last one that I baked and would take them to Vapor Room and let people have them, and then my friend and I would split the rest of the batch that we had it to pass out to our friends. I didn't actually sell it there anymore. I had baked for other clubs, but I didn't bake for Vapor Room. It's a Martha Stewart recipe. Lexi's favorite chocolate chip cookies. Now, I would modify it, of course. I would replace the flour with marijuana flour. And I also added, she only had a little bit of one kind of chocolate chip. I would put three different kinds of chocolate, and I added in three different kinds of nuts. And because, you know, I was thinking it's going to taste really weedy, and I didn't want it to taste like that. I wanted it to taste good. And that was the biggest hit, other than chocolate cream caramels, which I called Tootsies because we like Tootsie Rolls. But that's the best recipe I have, and just replace, you know, whatever your favorite recipes, and put the flour in it. And even if for the candy, I even ground it so fine that it was like confectionery sugar. It doesn't melt like confectionery sugar, but I used it like confectioner sugar along with the sugars in the candy, and that worked quite well. Candy seemed to actually be faster because it's more sugar, I guess. But whereas a regular like flour-based baked good seemed to take people, you know, 30 to 45 minutes maybe to start feeling it. The candy, people would start in like 15 minutes.
That's good to know.
And I don't mind, and that was just the joy of cooking's chocolate cream caramel recipe. And then I added some really finely ground powder to it. So those are my two favorite recipes. So whoever wants those, just use it. And use it in any way you want to. Replace it in your own favorite recipe.
Yeah, great. Here we go. All right, thank you. I'll do everything I can to share that.
So Elena's recipe is now your recipe. Our recipe. To spread far and wide. A recipe not only for cannabis-infused edibles, but I also feel I heard several other recipes during our conversation. recipes for how to run a cannabis collective, recipes for healing one another. I think one of the things that really stuck out for me in this conversation were the camaraderies of the old clubs and collectives, which speaks, in my opinion, to the burgeoning socialization of cannabis law reform. How to best nurture new paradigms with teamwork, sharing, and generosity. We also touched on a few topics that I anticipate revisiting in future episodes. How cannabis and exercise interact, cannabis and going to work, and of course, living in honesty, both as individuals and as a society. Thanks for joining our circle. This is Chris in Portland, and I'll see you next time on Coming Out of the Emerald Closet.